exactly what we are interested in. We are interested in understanding this matrix gamma AB, where AB are exactly these indices I1 up to IL. Can I have some color chalk, please? Is there color chalk somewhere?
Did you check inside the...
Yeah, the two boxes are empty. Thank you. So what is this object here from the point of view of the index I and J? You see that you have a field I, and then you have a J, and the I couples not to the neighbor, but to the next guy. So from the point of view of connecting the R charge, this is what this diagram does. You agree? So you have, for example, phi 1, phi 2, phi 1, phi 2. So phi 1, phi 2, phi 1, phi 2. Whereas this one here, it connects two neighbors, and then from the point of view of R charge, this is what it is. Okay? So here, again, I'm only representing now the R charge. Because if you want to also have the double line notation, then you can draw something like this, but it will be just very complicated. We can have this is for the R charge, and then inside we can indicate where the color is going, where the R charge is going by putting this. Okay? This will tell that this index is I, this index is J for the scale. Okay?
Question?
Yes.
What is R charge?
An R symmetry index. R symmetry is the symmetry that rotates this index. So when I say R charge or R symmetry index, or I'm always referring to this particular kind of indices. Contrary to color charge and color index, which is always the one represented by the double line. Okay, so this symmetry is called R charge. So what do we conclude? We conclude that the interesting diagram, from the point of view, so let's call this diagram A, A will be equal to what? It will be equal to the following. There will be a factor. So there will be this structure here. There will be this structure here for the indices. And there will be this structure here. Do you agree? These are all possible structures for the indices that I can have from this interaction vertex. This one, I can put it like this, or I can rotate it. Right? So by this, what do we mean? By this, we mean that we have delta I n going to j n plus 1, delta I n plus 1 going to j n, you see? Here we have what? We have delta I n plus 1, delta j n plus 1, thank you. And this one we have delta I n j n, delta I n plus 1, j n plus 1. But now, very important is the relative coefficient. You see that this vertex, right? This vertex here, I can use it in four orientations, and I can always use it. This one, for this structure, I can use it like this, or rotate by 180. So there are two configurations. And for the other one, there are other two. So the relative coefficient is 4 minus 2 minus 2. Okay? For the first vertex, there are four possible orientations. And for this one, two orientations contribute to this guy, and two contribute to this guy. Okay? So the result is, in terms of real indices, it's 4 times this structure, minus 2 times this structure, minus 2 times this structure. This is concerning the indices A and B, the I indices, times, of course, all the other delta functions, I1, J1, I2, J2, and so on, up to delta IL, JL. Right? Times the other ones, the ones not related to these two legs. Okay, then there is a factor of lambda, of tuped coupling from the vertex. Then there is the integral, where we integrate over. Let's do it in position space. I know It's the same as doing it in momentum space, like this point VZ. So we integrate over that point is, we have a propagator from X to that point Z to some power. Let me ask you to tell me what the power is. And we have a propagator from the point above, Y minus Z to some power. Where let this point be X, and let this space-time point be Y. So what power should I put here? So X minus Z to what power? What power should I put here? So what's the propagator between a point X and Z? It's 1 over X minus Z to the power? 2. How many propagators we have from X to Z?
2.
So what is the total power?
4.
Very good. 4? 4. Times what am I missing? What? Some pi's, right? Who cares? Propagator is 1 over 4 pi square and stuff like this, but that's it all. Very good. Now, so there are a momentum space or a position space integral and a color part or an art in this part. So let's see this part here. When is this divergent? Why is this divergent? We said we should look for the divergence. So when is this when is this integral problematic? When the point Z approaches what?
X or Y.
X or Y. So this integral, so let's call this integral I. So I as UV divergences for Z close to X or Z close to Y. And of course it's symmetric, so let's take Z close to X. So for Z close to X, the integral I is equal to what? The integral I is equal to an integral D for Z over X minus Z to the 4. This is our divergence. But now I can simplify a bit. You see that? Now, when I have y minus z, I can replace this by y minus x. Because z is close to x, right? And this is perfectly regular here. So I can really replace this by 1 over x minus y to the 4. So I take it out. Right? By the way, there's something else that I forgot. Times some spice. Times L minus 2 propagators. Remember that for all these other lines, I should put a propagator. So here, let me put it down here, there is also 1 over x minus y squared to the power L minus 2. Right? So, let's see that we are finding exactly the structure we want. You see? What's the total power of x minus y that is already outside? L minus 2 from here, plus 2, so it's L. That's exactly what we wanted to find. We wanted to find lambda, x minus y to the power 2L, and now we have to compute the integral to find this log lambda divergence. Right? So, the AB part is already outside, it's the delta function. The propagator part is already outside, and now we just have to compute this log part. So now we have to compute this integral here. So let's call this integral here I prime. And now I prime is very simple. You just go to the coordinates where you have z and you have z minus x equal to some psi. So change from z to psi. And then this integral will be just equal to an integral psi cubed xi, now you go to radial coordinates, times the integral over three spheres, the angular part, which is irrelevant, over psi to the 4, And now the interesting part is that this distance should go up to some cutoff, which will be 1 over lambda. And this is the ultraviolet cutoff. So you see that this gives, again, some pi's from the angular integration. And then it's the integral d xi of 1 over xi that gives log lambda. Yes?
So here, in the delta li, ui, you have until l minus 2, right?
No, up to l, and there are two that are missing. That's why I wrote here, otherwise.
And why here the cutoff is 1 over lambda?
That's the definition of the cutoff. The cutoff is the ultraviolet cutoff that cuts off short distances. So instead of integrating up to 0, we put a circle of length 2 over the cutoff, of a diameter 2 over the cutoff, and we integrate over distances bigger than that cutoff to regularize it. Right? That's just the definition of a normalization. Putting a cutoff at large momenta or short distances is the same.
Yeah, so this cutoff is in the momentum space.
Yeah, if you want 1 over cutoff for... Yeah, when you have a cutoff in momentum space, it translates into 1 over cutoff in position space. So you can think that this 1 over cutoff as being a lattice space. Okay, is this clear? So you get just log pi. So okay, so let me summarize. Log lambda we found, all the propagators we found, and we found the matrix structure. So let me write down the full result of diagram A. In diagram A, now I will give you the factors of pi is the following. It's minus lambda over 16 pi squared. So these are all the pi's that we missed. Then there is this diagram. Minus twice this diagram plus this diagram. So this is just the R charge index times log of cutoff square over x minus y square. This x minus y square we can reproduce it just by dimensions, or if I would be more rigorous here, I could show you that the upper cutoff should be x minus y because it's an infrared cutoff for that approximation, but forget about the x minus y if you want and consider only the log lambda over x minus y to the power 2l. Okay? So the conclusion is that, remember what we should do. We should look at the divergence in log lambda. There is a minus here. The minus I already stepped out by convening for that reason. There is a lambda, so we can immediately extract this gamma now. Okay? So what is this gamma? So the matrix gamma is equal to lambda over 16 pi squared. Okay, there I have the lambda outside. So let me just, no, this is a slightly different convention, but it's, if you want, take out the lambda. Times what? Now, this interaction can happen at many places. So I have a sum from n equal 1 up to l. And then what do I do from the point of view of the indices? I do nothing up to the position n. And at positions n and n plus 1, I have this possibility. Minus twice the one where the indices are exchanged, plus, and now I will put here alpha, and I'll come back to this in a second, times this one where the indices are the same. So this is the matrix gamma, where these pictures, of course, mean a bunch of delta functions that tell you how the indices are related in the bottom and the top. Now, notice something very important. I claim that this is the result for all diagrams, not only the one we just computed. Why is this true? Because notice that this diagram is the only one, due to the interaction, where the indices of these guys can change. The gluon doesn't carry this R charge. It doesn't carry indices. So this index here, if this is I, this one is also I. If this is I, this one is also I. So all these diagrams, do they contain log lambda divergences? They do. But they only contribute to the structure where the indices are the same in the bottom and in the top. So all they can do is shift our matrix and renormalize this off. So it's in this sense that the interesting part, which is the part, you see this is a contribution proportional to the identity. You agree? It is just proportional to the identity. It just shifts all dimensions by a given constant. It's really the boring part. And the interesting part, the part that gives an untrivial matrix structure, is really only coming from this diagram. If you do all the diagrams, you find that alpha is equal to 2. But actually, now it's a question of taste. What do you prefer? Just one thing. We can claim, we can either do the diagrams, or we can actually fix this alpha to be 2 by an argument that I will give you in about 10 minutes or so. Okay? Yes. This is an important computation in conformal field theory, so please tell me if there is any question. So we look for the log of the divergence, we find it, and we read off the matrix. So the goal would be, once we compute alpha, the next step is to diagonalize this matrix. That's the only thing we have to do.
So what about diagrams with two vertices of one vertex? With two interaction vertices?
If they have more interaction, they will contribute at higher orders in lambda. So we are interested in the lowest order in lambda right now. So we are starting perturbation theory. We had some classical dimension, and now we are doing the one loop effect, considering the first correction to the classical dimension. But that's a very good question that I will come back to it maybe in 15 minutes. Any question? Is it clear? Yes.
How do you exactly see all the other diagrams going to contribute to that kind of?
The distinctive feature of this diagram alpha is that the indices of our charge are not changed.
Yeah, but they're not changed in the first one either.
Sorry?
Oh, okay.
No, in the first one, they are, for example, here you can have 1, 1, and here 2, 2, for example. And that gives an unzero result. But you see that this diagram, you cannot have 1, 1 going to 2, 2, because you have a particle which is a scalar of type 1, it emits a gluon, it continues to be a scalar of type 1. Right? You see that in the interaction with the gluons, you have a term like phi 1, a mu phi 1.
But if you follow the propagator, the second diagram you have,
etc. And all diagrams, the only guys that contain R charge are the scalar.
It's just that the one that has the gluon propagator.
Yes.
If you were to naively follow the line of I, for example, the one that's connected to the gluon propagator, you get back to I plus 1. Or am I just naive?
This one here?
No, the previous one.
This one?
Yeah.
So here you have an index, a scalar phi 1.
Yeah.
Now, which vertex do you want to use that emits the gluon? The scalar that emits the gluon, the vertex is this one.
Yeah.
So it emits the gluon, but it continues to be a phi 1.
Okay.
I mean, physically, it's just a statement that you have this symmetry, and the gluon does not carry any charge.
Okay.
According to, it's not charged under this R charge. So by emitting gluons, you don't change your carrier. So all these diagrams, they just contribute to the identity part of that matrix, to delta AB, which is the last part there. Now, before I tell you why alpha should be 2, again, you can believe me, it's just a question of doing Feynman diagrams. It's actually not such an interesting thing. You can just now, it's actually a good exercise that I strongly recommend to do one more diagram and to just see that you get, again, another contribution to log lambda. I really encourage you to do that. But before settling that alpha is equal to 2 by another argument that will rely on supersymmetry, let me explain that there is a very useful way of thinking about these matrices by thinking of this thinking about these operators I1 up to IL as being a spin chain, where at each side of my spin chain, and I have L sides, I have an SO6 vector which can take value I1, then I2, then I3, and so on. It's just a question of notation, but it's often a convenient one. It does help to think about this spin, about this. So we think that trace of phi1, phi2, phi I1, phi I2, up to phi IL. Let's think of this, just a question of notation, as I1, I2, up to IL. So literally, all we do is change the trace into a cat and ignore the phi's. Just a question of notation. Then, gamma, that was acting on operators, becomes equivalent to an operator, which we will call a Hamiltonian, that acts on states. What is this operator H? Well, it's very simple. Let's just read it off from there. It's lambda over 16 pi squared, sum from n equal 1 up to L, and then there is an operator k that acts on sides n plus 1, minus 2 times an operator p that acts on sides n plus 1, plus alpha times an operator I that acts on sides n plus 1. And alpha, we know, is equal to 2. Where, what are these operators? Where? We have the identity, let's start by the right to left, identity acting on sides I and j give just I and j. Permutation permutes the two. Permutation acting on I and j gives j and I. It permutes the two indices. And trace acting on I and j, can someone tell me what this should give to mimic that?
Delta
ij, that's good. It's 0 unless I is equal to j, and then?
Times 6.
Sorry?
No.
No, it should be. So delta ij, that's correct. And now? So think while I will erase this bottom part. The other two are clear, right? Identity and permutation, it's obvious, right? Identity just takes ij to ij, and permutation permutes the two.
The cat should be unchanged, right?
Sorry?
The cat should be unchanged. It should be just delta ij times
the
cat.
This index must be equal to this one,
yeah.
And this one must be equal to this one, but not necessarily the same as the original one. So I have 1, 1, it can go to 1, 1, or to 2, 2, or to 3, 3, or to 4, 4, or to 5, 5, or to 6, 6. So what should I put there?
Sum over all pairs.
Very good. I should put sum from k equal 1 up to 6, kk. Yeah? Clear? They must be equal, and then it produces any of the possible 6 possibilities. Now, so this is point 1. We computed gamma. We computed this matrix. We chose to represent the vector space as an Hilbert space. And now we have to compute. So all we have to do is diagonalize this Hamiltonian H, and the energies such that energy times psi equal Hamiltonian times psi, the eigen energies of this Hamiltonian, these are the anomalous dimensions. And the eigenvectors are the operators with definite dimension. Yeah? It's clear? We just have to diagonalize this matrix. The energy of this Hamiltonian, of this pincher Hamiltonian, will be the dimensions of the operators in n equals 4. And the eigenvectors will be the operators with good dimension. Now, in this, all we have to do, there is a small caveat. We just have to diagonalize H, which is a 6 to the L times 6 to the L matrix. So this is really not a just, I mean, this is a big pain. If I have like L equal 10, you can imagine, like a chain of 10 sides, diagonalize a 6 to the 10 by 6 to the 10 matrix. Right? But that's life. In principle, in general, in a general conformal field theory, so far we didn't, we just used a specific interactions in n equals 4, but all the computations would go exactly the same way for any gauge theory, which would be a conformal gauge theory. In principle, that's our fate. We have to diagonalize this huge matrix. Unless there is a miracle. Unless it turns out that this Hamiltonian is a special one. The only thing that can come to rescue is if somehow the Hamiltonian that we have to solve is exactly solvable, if it belongs, if it's an integrable Hamiltonian. So, this computation that I just showed you here was done by Minahan and Zarem, 2003. And what they realized is that they looked at the particular form of the Hamiltonian, H, and H is proportional to a sum from n equal 1 up to L of k minus 2 permutation plus some constant times identity. The constant is irrelevant, but there is a very precise ratio, minus 1 half or minus 2, depends how you read, between these two structures. Okay? But now you call your Russian friends, who are the specialists in integrable models, and you ask them, look, dear Russian, I have an Hamiltonian here, and it has a trace and a permutation. And he will reply, yes, tell me. And then you tell him, this Hamiltonian, the coefficient you have a permutation, and then you have minus 1 half of trace. And then his eyes open a lot, because he knows that these are exactly the precise coefficient that you must have for the Hamiltonian to be exactly solvable. So this is exactly the ratio, it's like a miracle, it's exactly what makes this Hamiltonian exactly solvable. And this was the discovery that boosted an entire field of research that normally goes by the name of integrability in gauge gravity development. It was this observation that that Minahan and Zarembo did, that the dilatation operator can be mapped to an Hamiltonian. Okay, so far so good, that's trivial. But a really non-trivial insight is that that particular Hamiltonian is not any Hamiltonian. It's not any 6 to the L by 6 to the L matrix. It's a very special one, which we call an integrable one. What integrability is physically and what does it translate into is what we are going to see perhaps even a bit today, but certainly tomorrow. But for now, keep in mind that it's some particular class of physical models that are exactly solvable. So let's continue our exploration, and let's, despite the fact that this looks like a very hard problem, let's try to solve it by trying to simplify it as much as possible. So now we are in step 2, diagonalizing this matrix, or this Hamiltonian. But first, remember something that we considered in the previous lecture. In the previous lecture, we did not consider strings that are moving in S5, in the full S5. Remember, we never considered. We had six components, X1 up to X6. We never excited all of them. Right? You remember we did X1 plus X2 once. Right? And then we did one solution which used X1, X2, X3, and X4. So it was at most moving in a three sphere inside the S5. We never used the full S5. So because we will want to match later with strong coupling, and because this is a big simplification, let's try to not to be so ambitious and study operators made out of all scalars, but let's consider, instead of the SO6 sector, let me tell you about a reduction for a so-called SU2 sector. And this reduction is just tells you that you should only consider these two scalars, Z, that we saw yesterday, phi1 plus I, phi2, and X, which is phi3 plus I, phi4. And this guy, now that you only have two types of scalars, it's interesting to think about this one as being a spin up and this one as being a spin down. Then our spin chain will really look like a usual spin chain, where spins are up and down. Now, what happens when I have permutation acting on whatever, say Z and X? This just gives X and Z. Permutation acting on, sorry. And what about trace? Trace is the interesting one. Acting on Z and X, or even trace acting on Z and Z. So what about the first line? What does trace give acting on Z and X? What?
Zero.
Zero. This one is obvious. Why is it zero? Because Z and X, they don't contain any scalar in common, so it's immediately zero. What about the last one? K acting on ZZ. Z is phi 1 plus I phi 2, and the other Z is phi 1 plus I phi 2.
Also zero.
Why?
Because of the I.
Because of the I. Because this, only the ones 1, 1, and 2, 2 interest. So this is K acting on phi 1, phi 1, plus K acting on I phi 2, which gives a minus sign, minus phi 2, phi 2. And because they give the same, and because of the relative minus sign, we get zero. A physical way of thinking about this is that by doing this linear combination, we charge the scalar. Now the scalar has charge under this U1 symmetry that rotates phi1 and phi2. So it's like you have two charged scalars, you cannot just contract them. In other words, by doing these combinations, the lines now have arrows. And it's not possible to just contract two arrows. But this is the explicit mathematical verification of that. So we conclude that in this sector, the Hamiltonian, we can ignore the trace. The trace never plays any role. And the Hamiltonian becomes just lambda over 8 pi square, sum from n equal 1 up to infinity, identity acting on m n plus 1, minus permutation acting on n n plus 1. Okay? And this is the Heisenberg X spin chain. I put a 1/2 to indicate it's spin 1/2. So this here, remember this is alpha over 2. This guy. If we had not computed alpha, right now we would write here alpha over 2. Okay. So now, let's try to study some energies of these Hamiltonians. Of course, these Hamiltonians, they act on a very big Hilbert space. 6 to the L times 6 to the L in that case, and in this case? Sorry?
2 to the L.
2 to the L times 2 to the L, at each side we have spin up or spin down, but still it's quite big. So let's act first on small states, even though the dimensions are big. Acting on small states, we can really make progress easily.
But this is still sparse, right?
Sorry?
This is a sparse matrix.
It's still quite sparse. Still quite sparse. It's true. It only involves nearest neighbors. So this, of course, this we really call it an Hamiltonian in the usual sense. This is really a nearest neighbor Hamiltonian. So it is sparse. But still, in general, it will be very hard to diagonalize. By the way, remember that in the very beginning of psi, when we were studying Mathematica, this was exactly the Hamiltonian we were working with. We were exactly diagonalizing this Hamiltonian. And we computed for a couple of L's, but you remember at some point we could not do better than L equal, I don't know how much we did, but like 16, 17, something like that. That was really the best we could do. And then we extrapolated and we computed the energy of the antiferromagnetic state of this Hamiltonian, right? Remember? So that you already have a prediction for n equals 4. States which correspond to this antiferromagnetic vacuum, which are many z's and x's, which alternate roughly, they will have some anomalous dimension that will be given by the numerical prediction that we had in the first lecture. And for finite L, contrary to condensed matter, here we want all possible lengths. You just don't throw away the results at finite L. The results at finite L are the anomalous dimensions of operators of finite lengths. So all this data that we had from the lectures in Mathematica, where we compute the energies of these states for lengths 2, 4, 6, and so on, they are anomalous dimensions of these operators, particular anomalous dimensions. The one for particular eigenvectors, the eigenvectors corresponding to the antiferromagnetic vacuum. So we computed one kind of anomalous dimension. Now, notice what happens if we act. Let's start by the simplest possible state. What's the simplest possible state you can act on? On a spin change that spins up and down.
All of them up.
That's a very good proposal. So let's act with this Hamiltonian with all of them up. Right? Remember, what is this operator? If there are L sides, this corresponds to the operator Z to the L. Ah. Right? All of them up. If I use the note, up. Is Z to the L. Very good. What do we get? Then, whenever you act on a side on two sides, identity or permutation give exactly the same thing. And they both do nothing because they are already up, up. So permute or identity is the same. So you get the same thing. Sorry, here it's not infinity. It's L. Please. It's not infinity, of course, L. So what do you get? On each of the L possible sides where it can act, you get alpha over 2 minus 1. So you see that this is equal to 0 for alpha equal to 2. So those who are more supersymmetry oriented, you could say, I will use my supersymmetry non-renormalization arguments to know that for this state, it should be zero, the anomalous dimension. Because remember that for that state, we had seen that the classical dimension was J1, the strong coupling dimension was J1, and then we said the curve should be just flat, and J1 for any coupling. That means there should be no anomalous dimension. If there should be no anomalous dimension by that guy, then we can fix alpha by requiring that the energy of that state is zero. Of course, we would have to prove and to do all the supersymmetry representation theory arguments to show that. So there are two options. Either go and learn a bit of representation theory. That's one option. The second option is do the diagrams and find alpha equal to 2. The third option is to say, okay, at tree level the energy was J1. At strong coupling the energy was J1. It's a bit hard to believe that the energy will change in the middle. And that's the hand-waving argument once you know the result is correct. Okay, so from now on we really fix alpha to be 2. So we computed our first anomalous dimension. The anomalous dimension for the operator trace of z to the L is equal to 0. Okay, that we knew. I mean, we knew. I had told you already, but this is how we verify it. So as an exercise, I have proposed this as an exercise, but maybe we can really do it because there's not much time to go into the next topic, so let's do this. Let's do two exercises. Let's find all anomalous dimensions for SU2 operators of dimension of delta naught equal to 4. Okay? So let's start. Trace of, let me write it in this way, z, 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 z. Okay, this one is easy, right? What is the anomalous dimension?
Zero.
Zero. Now with one x. Now, as you pointed out, because of cyclicity, there's only one possibility. You put some x, doesn't matter where. Let's put z, 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 x, for example. Right? All the states are good. Now, let me write the result. Gamma is equal to 0. Now, this one is also obvious, because what you are doing is the following. You have a spin chain of length 4. And you have up, 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 up. Now act with a lowering operator that converts up into down. Right? So what do you get if you act with, so this is the state up, 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 up. And if you act with a lowering operator on this state, you just get, well, you get down in each of the possible positions. Right? You have the total lowering operator. But of course, this Hamiltonian is SU2 symmetric. It commutes, the Hamiltonian commutes with total spin. It commutes with any component. The Hamiltonian commutes with any component SA, total spin. So the energy of this state is the same as just ferromagnetic vacuum. It is just a ferromagnetic vacuum pointing in another direction. You just rotate it a bit. But it's the same ferromagnetic vacuum. And this state, you see, from the point when you impose cyclicity, all these states are equivalent there. And this is what you get. So this, from this, is just a rotation. So they should, of course, have the same dimension. It's just acting with a global symmetry that just puts a spin down in all possible positions. Is it clear? And let's see explicitly why it is zero. Let the Hamiltonian act here. So now please follow me. The Hamiltonian acts here, you get zero. The Hamiltonian acts here, you get zero. Right? Because it's identity minus permutation. When it acts here, what do you get? Well, the identity does nothing. The permutation gives a minus sign and flips them. But the final state is the same because of the trace. So it's also zero. So on each possible side, either you get zero because it's obviously zero, or you get zero when you use cyclicity of the trace. Okay? But the group theory, the good argument is just to show that with one excitation, the only state that exists is this one, and this one is exactly, you see, that one there. Now, On the other hand, if we have just x's, then of course exactly the same argument, gamma is equal to 0. And we can then apply a rotation and get the operator where you have 1z. Okay? So finally, we have something interesting. Now we can have the operator z, x, z, x, or trace of z, z, x, x. Okay? So, and now there are two combinations that you have on this case. You have one which is just s minus square acting on up, 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 up. And that one will just have gamma equal to 0. Right? And this one will be just a sum of putting two spins down in any possible position. So it will be up, say, down, down, up, up, plus permutations. So this one, which has coefficient 1 for all states, and it is just put plus in all possible positions, is just a global symmetry of the vacuum, so that has gamma equal to 0. And then we have the other one, the other state. So this is one linear combination, and then you have the other one, which is, let me write, and then we can check or derive whatever you prefer, which is up, down, minus up, up, down, down. And this has dimension, what is 12? 12 over 8? 12 over 8 is what? It's 6 over 4, I think. 3 over. And this one has dimension gamma equal 3 lambda over 2 pi squared. Okay. But again, you can really write a linear combination, act with Hamiltonian, and show that there are two eigenvalues, 1, 0, and 1, which is this one. Okay. So this is an example where for length 4, there's really only one interesting state. By the way, if you want to know, this is what is called the Konishi state. And you see, it's the simplest possible state that you have when you start, when you consider the SU2 second. Because you see, if you have delta naught equal to 2 or delta naught equal to 3, actually everyone is either vacuum or vacuum descendants. So really, the first non-trivial normal dimensions is with delta naught equal to 4, and it's this one here, and it's called the Konishi state, or the Konishi operator. Now, as an exercise 2, let's find O gamma, and the corresponding operators, of course, O gamma, for delta naught equal to 2 in the SO6 sector. Okay, so I go to delta naught equal to 2, but I allow myself to consider any kind of scale. So we want to consider our operators, which are psi ij times ij. I sum over I and j. So I have some wave function, and then ij. Now, when you have this SO6, you see that what you have here, okay, when alpha is equal to 2, notice what happens. When alpha is equal to 2, so the Hamiltonian, let me write, is equal to lambda over 16 pi squared, right? lambda over 16 pi square, sum of twice the identity minus twice permutation plus 3. Now, and in this case, L is equal to 2. Now, you see that because you have identity minus permutation, because you have identity minus permutation, this identity minus permutation, you kill anything that is symmetric, because identity minus permutation is an antisymmetrizer. It's exactly a projector into antisymmetric. So you see that on the other hand, you have trace of phi I, phi j. So trace of phi I, phi j is symmetric, because it's trace of phi I, phi j plus trace of phi j, phi I, because of the cyclicity of the trace. So this term here never contributes. So this one does not contribute for L equal to 2. Because you are always acting on these two sides, and because of cyclicity of the trace, I always have that I can always symmetrize these two sides. And this guy is a projector into antisymmetric. So now I have two indices that are symmetrized, and now there are two options. The trace, either they are symmetrized and traceless, or they are just trace. So I have two classes of operators, so only this guy contributes. So I have some operators that I can call Oij, which are trace of phi I, phi j, minus the trace. So minus, I'm not sure if I will get the number right, but probably it's correct, 1 over 6 delta ij trace of phi k, phi k. This one, it's obviously symmetric, but it's traceless. When I act with a trace, these two guys, if I did it correctly, should cancel exactly with the action there. And then I have another operator that I will call OK, which is just trace of phi k, phi k. There is a sum over k here. So let's see if I did it correct. So my claim is that this guy has gamma equal to 0. Let's first work out the gamma of the last one, because that's quite simple. So please follow. So when you act with Hamiltonian here, you act on this phi k, phi k, and you reproduce again the sum. Right? So if you act on phi 1, phi 1, you act and you get the full operator again. You act on phi 2, phi 2, and you get the full operator again. So you get 6 times the full operator. Okay? So we get the gamma will be equal to lambda over 16 pi square times 6, because each time I act on each of the terms in the sum, I get the full operator again. And I can act on sides, where is it here? 1, 2 or 2, 1. Remember, this is cyclic, and I can act on 1, 2 or 2, 1. So times 2. Ah, and this is correct, and that one is not. So, and this is 12 over 16. How much is 12 over 16? It's 3 over 4, no? Yeah. And I know that, yeah, this should be also 3 over 4. So these two guys, they have the same anomalous dimension. Can you imagine a reason why two operators would have the same anomalous dimension? Of course, one reason is it's a coincidence. What is the other possible reason? Sorry?
They are the same.
They are the same in what sense? So this guy, I call it K already because Konishi starts with K. What could be the reason that I could get two equal anomalous dimensions? Of course, coincidence, I said. And the other reason is, when can two things have the same dimension? For example, why do these two guys have the same dimension? What was the argument? They are the same dimension because? Sorry? Because they were?
Related by rotation.
Because they were related by a rotation, a symmetry. So if you have two operators and if you act with the symmetry of the theory, you go to another operator that must have the same dimension. So these two guys, they have the same dimension because they are related by supersymmetry. So they are related by a superrotations. And superrotations change the number of fields and so on. So the explanation for this coincidence is that these two guys, they are both in the same super multiplet. In the same way that these two guys, they are in the same multiplet of spin. They are in the spin equal 4 component of the same representation group, the representation. And you just rotate into the different elements inside that representation. And of course, you have the same dimension for all of them. And again, let's do this one by head. Let's see why this one is 0. Because again, when you act here, what do we get? You get delta ij. Please follow. You act here and you get delta ij times the sum. That's what we wrote there in the corner. So when you act here, you get delta ij times the sum. What do we get when we have here? When you act on each of these guys, you get the sum. But you have 6 of these, so it cancels the 6 and you get that delta ij times the sum. So it cancels that and you get 0 in there. So we conclude that there are a set of operators, this one and that one, that have 0 anomalous dimension. And actually, it turns out that even though there are many guys with 0, and not all are related by supersymmetry, because you can just have z to the l for different l's, they are not related by supersymmetry. But it turns out that actually these ones and that ones are also related by supersymmetry. So everyone in this blackboard that has the same anomalous dimension is indeed related by supersymmetry. Okay, so
for example, if you find anomalous dimensions that are 0, yes, are all of them related by supersymmetry?
No. If they are non-zero, almost for sure, yes. If they are 0, no. If you have z to the 5 and z to the 200, both are 0 by supersymmetry arguments, but you cannot apply supersymmetry and go from z to the 200 to z to the 5. Supersymmetry can do small changes in the operator, not such huge changes. So let me just tell you, we see that something very, very nice happened. We met the problem in four-dimensional physics, which was the problem of computing two-point functions of the CFT at two points in four-dimensional space-time. We saw that this problem was equivalent to a one-dimensional spin chain problem. Now, let me just indicate, and then we will stop, what kind of spin chain are we dealing with? So what kind of spin chain are we dealing with? So what do I mean by this? So we saw that the spin chain was here an SU2 spin chain, but because we considered a smaller sector of the theory. In general, for all the scalars, it would be SO6. But there are even more than scalars. There are scalars, there are derivatives, there are fermions, there are other stuff that I could construct. So the first thing is that at each side of the spin chain, we have some A, where this A, it can be many things. It can be, as we said, a scalar, phi I, which we denoted just by I. It could be some fermion, psi, one of the fermions we saw. It could also be, for example, covariant derivatives, many times, for example, acting on scalars. This is also an object that transforms perfectly fine. Okay? So this is So it contains scalar and fermionic degrees of freedom. So of course, it's a super spin chain. Okay? It also contains at each side, it can contain an infinite number of possibilities. You see, you can put any number of derivatives at the side. It's not really choosing just from 1 to 6. It's really any possible number of the covariant derivatives on top of each side. So it will also be an n-compact, in the sense that the Hilbert space, even at each side, is infinite, spin chain. And we saw that the simplest one we saw today was SU2. SU2 was inside. I never know how to draw inside. SU2 is contained in, it's like this, right? SU2 is contained in the more general one, which is SO6, which is contained in the full one. Did someone ever heard the name of what could be the group that incorporates all these guys? So it must incorporate SO6. Okay? What are we going to put here? It must be something that must contain SO6, which, by the way, I remind you, is equal to SU4. It contains also the conformal group, SO2,4, which is SU2,2. You just put some commas there and there. So it must be something that contains SU4 and SU2,2. It must have some symmetry, at least 2,2 and at least SU4. And then there's also supersymmetry that relates the two. And there is something called a supergroup, which is a group that, whose bosonic part is these two groups, but it also contains supersymmetry. And this is what's PSU2,2/4. Okay? But of course, you don't understand very well what this is, so just add up 2 + 2 + 4 and think that it's like an SU8 spin chain, roughly. But very roughly, because it's uncompact and so on. But this is what it is mathematically, and then we can discuss more, and I can, this is the symmetry group. So it will be a super non-compact spin chain with this symmetry in general, with PSU2,2/4 symmetry. What about what kind of interactions will this spin chain have? What kind of interactions? Well, we saw that at one loop, all we have to do is consider these kind of interactions. Why? Why did we only consider those kind of nearest neighbor interactions? Because of planarity. Now, what would happen if you go to two loops? Now consider one more loop. Now you could start, so at two loops, for example, you could also have now another interaction, and the interaction would go a bit further away. You agree? So this would be at order lambda squared. So in general, the Hamiltonian will have an expansion which will have lambda times a nearest neighbor Hamiltonian plus lambda squared times a next to nearest neighbor interaction plus lambda cubed times a next to nearest neighbor interaction. Okay? Plus, etc. In other words, we have to deal with a long-range super non-compact spin chain with PSU2,2/4. So it's quite a beast. So in principle, this is what solving this conformal field theory, and by that I mean in this restricted sense of computing all two dimensions, all two-point functions of the conformal field theory. So getting the two-point function of the conformal field theory is equivalent to solving that spin chain. And now you can say, okay, but I will run out of luck. This was already quite a coincidence that this SO6 Hamiltonian was exactly integrable. Now we will really need exponentially more luck for these higher loops, all this symmetry and so on. And that turns out to be remarkable. And the most remarkable thing, which is not written in this box, and the most remarkable thing is that, and that's what we should also add, this turns out to be integral. And this is really beyond anything we could have asked for. I mean, this is really quite spectacular. And actually, apart from ADS-CFT, there is no explanation why were we so lucky to get this kind of mirror. From ADS-CFT, there is, because it turns out that these classical equations of motion that we solved yesterday, they are integrable in a sense. So you could say that if there is ADS-CFT, and if classical integrability of the string survives quantization, then the gauge theory should somehow inherit the integrability of the string theory. And that's an indirect argument. But really, from the point of view of just n equals 4, saying, OK, we have this miracle that we get this very interesting, non-compact, long-range spin chain. Why is it integrable? There is not yet a deep explanation, despite many advances in that direction. And I might tell you a bit more about these remarkable hidden structures in future lectures. Yeah, that's it. So tomorrow we will diagonalize this SU2 spin chain, not now for particular examples, this is boring, of course you can do more if you want, but we will present a general solution by means of using integrability, and I will tell you what the Bittan-Zatz is and how to use the Bittan-Zatz techniques for computing, solving completely this problem and getting the anomalous dimensions of the theory. Any question? Yes.
So can we move this integrability of this Hamiltonian to see that this correlation, that the result that we got from localization? So can we do that?
That's an excellent question. So can we use this exactly solvable techniques going by the name of integrability to relate them to other kind of exactly solvable techniques that are called the localization? This is possible. It was only realized a few weeks ago by a paper by Maldacena, Hamid, Hen, and Correa, Hamid Sever and Correa, where they showed that some energies that can be computed by these spin chain techniques can also be computed by computing some generalization of the circular Wilson loop that we discussed last time. But that maybe let me postpone answering that in more detail to the last or next to the last lecture. More questions? By the way, did you see the Bittan-Zatz during the course? Maybe in condensed matter or something or no? No. So tomorrow we will do spin chain physics. We forget about n equals 4, we forget Feynman diagrams. Tomorrow we do spin chains.